originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, wherever you may be. Trainer Talk is on the air. This show, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to, and I'm delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest. Tonight's trainer has had a long and storied career in thoroughbred racing. He's worn several hats along the way. He's cultivated countless relationships with racing participants, from hot walkers to Hall of Famers, and his memory bank of racing stories and lore is endless. Certainly for our listeners, he is most noted as being the sire of the Beast of the Belmont, also known as the Big A. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Tony Stabile. How's it going,
Thank
Tony?
You very much. Nice to be here.
Glad you could make it today. You made the long drive from Brooklyn up to Saratoga.
Actually, from Erie. Live in Erie now.
Oh, you live in Erie now. Oh, cool.
Yeah, I live right near the racetrack, Presque Isle Downs.
Beautiful. Yeah, because you race there quite a bit. You go back and forth between there and Golden Gate Fields.
Yes, sir. From May to October, we're at Presque Isle, and from October to May, we're at Golden Gate.
So you stay on the Tapeta surface.
Yes. Yeah. And also to both organizations. I'm very fortunate to have a good relationship with the people at Presque Isle and the Shawnee Group in California.
Well, that's
so
good.
You know, they make it that much easier for a trainer to do his business.
Yeah, well, they certainly, run tight ships both places. So you're in good shape. Let's start at the very beginning. Who exposed you to thoroughbred racing?
Well, I went to school with a trainer's son named Mike Sedlak, and Mike invited me out to the barn one morning, and I quit school 2 weeks later.
That was it. Love at first sight, kind of.
So anybody has any beefs, see Mike Sedlak. He created this Frankenstein.
That's great. So you started working at the barn and little
Kyle
by
Walker, I worked for Woody Sedlak, Mike's father, who's probably one of the 10 best trainers I've ever seen in my life. I mean, the man was like, he was Dr. Doolittle / Horse Whisperer. I've never seen a man get along with horses and animals like Woody was. Quiet man, nice man, nice family, and a heck of a trainer. Then I worked for Tony Basil on Wamazon Farm a couple of years. And rose to foreman there for a while. And I worked for a gentleman from New England named Bob McCarty, who was very under the radar, but he was a great trainer. All he claimed and bought were horses with bow tendons and horses that were bleeders. And there was no Lasix allowed in those years. And I learned a lot from him. I learned how to handle the bow tendon. I learned how to handle bleeders. And then my relationships with other trainers, I knew Bobby Franco when he first started walking horses for Buddy Jacobson. Alan Jerkins is my best friend in the world. Many talks with Alan. I learned more from Alan just by watching him in the barn, than most people would learn in a lifetime. And yeah. Pancho Martin and Jose Martin. Just the list goes on and on. Just great, great trainers. And I was able to, take a little piece from everybody.
Yeah, that's together. That's kind of the way it works when you have that background of working for a lot of different trainers. You kind of figure out what works for them, what you think will work for you, and cast aside the things that you disagree with. But some of those guys that you're talking about, you can't disagree with them too much.
Exactly, and especially when it comes to remedies and paints for horses, you know, you'll mix up. Trainers, a lot of trainers have their own formulas for paints and liniments and stuff like that. And I was able to witness like 6-7 guys mixing their paints. So when I went out on my own, I became like a mad scientist. And through trial and error, I was blessed to be able to find the right combinations that work and keep horses sound and stuff like that. You know, it's not as easy as people think. I mean, when people watch the races, especially if they're not race trackers, you know, they think you just get a horse, you put a saddle and a jockey on them, and see you later.
Right.
You know, it's more complicated than the general public thinks. I just wish more tracks would be into educating the fans. I think the problem with the game is that whomever was in charge of advertising for the baby boomers blew it, because they didn't. They didn't promote the baby boomers. See, my parents, my generation, our parents took us to the races.
Right.
That is the generation now that you'll find mostly at the track. You know, for me, I was a horseman, so I took my kids to the track. So, and that's how you wound up with that bargain basement prize, Anthony Stabile. You know? I mean, not because he's my son. I mean, the guy's nuts. I mean, he just knows about horse racing. He's got a memory like a vault. It's incredible, you know, and he knows about ailments too, because he watched me, you know, fight it out for all those years with cheap horses and driving to Philly Park and Atlantic City and Monmouth and the Meadowlands. You know, he's a pretty good horseman. He knows what he's doing around a horse, too.
Yeah, he, you know, he
so
knows.
Don't let him fool you. He not only knows about the game itself and can handicap, he knows about horses, too.
Yeah, because he talks a lot of times on the show about, you know, going to those racetracks with you and problem this horse had or that horse. And, you know, like you said, it's not an easy racket. People think it's all, you know, going out in the morning, drinking coffee with your fellow trainers, and then, you know, going right out and collecting money in the afternoon. And it's not like that at all. I mean,
well,
it's a hard life.
2 years in Presque Isle and in Golden Gate, I had 20 horses. I carried 20 horses. Now, 20 horses means 4 grooms. In California, we have a hot walking machine that I could put 4 horses on at one time. But still, you can't just put them on a hot walker machine, especially if they're breezing. So I have to hire 4 grooms, 2 hot walkers, 2 exercise riders, have to worry about the feed guy, the tack guy, the vets, the blacksmith, the workman's compensation. And that has nothing to do with my personal life. That's just business. You know, people don't realize how a trainer's life is so consumed. Especially when you're carrying a lot of horses, you're just constantly thinking about them. You know, I tell everybody the story, and it's to this day, it intrigues me. I used to go by Alan Jerkins at night after we would hay off the horses at the barn at Belmont. And Alan would go home, and Alan loved the honeymooners. He watched every honeymoon episode about 17,000 times. He could actually quote them. And we'd sit on the couch, and I'd sit on the right side on the end, and he'd sit towards the middle and point his legs to the left. And at the bottom of his legs was a blackboard. And also, and now here's an unknown fact that nobody, not too many people knew. Alan Jerkins smoked. He smoked Kent cigarettes. He would smoke a couple before he went to bed because he said they would put him to sleep. I wasn't going to argue with him about that. So anyway, we'd be watching the honeymooners and talking, and all of a sudden he'd pop up use his thumb, erase something, and mark something else. He'd have the board. There'd be a board in front of him with 40 or 44 horses' names on it, whatever, whomever he had in the barn, obviously. And he'd be sitting there and oh, that Ed Norton kills me. Oop. He'd jump up, change another thing. You know, so he constant, even when in his rest, when he was resting at home, he was still thinking about what he was going to do when he got to that barn in the morning and changing, you know, certain patterns for horses and stuff like that. The guy was a genius, the greatest. You know, but that's what it takes. You got to. That's why there's an 85% divorce rate amongst trainers.
I didn't know that number.
Say, but yeah. It looks like you got to choose between your career and the horses or family. That's why it's very important for a trainer to, if they're going to have a significant other, to have somebody that's in tune with them and loves the game like he does or she does. It's not easy. Believe me, it's not easy. And the traveling and the worrying and the equipment and the medications and make sure that the groom didn't give this or make sure this guy didn't switch tubs and mix something accidentally. You know, it's very intricate, very intricate.
Yeah, and the trainer has to stay on top of all of that. Plus, he has to deal with the clients and he has to, you know, go over the condition book and pick the right spots. And then you got to deal with the jockey agents and all that. You were a jockey agent too.
I became an agent because I was too lazy to work and too nervous to steal. I was fortunate though. I was very, very fortunate. A fellow named Bobby Woodhouse gave me my first chance to cut my teeth, so to say. And I worked for Bobby 11 months. We went about 27 races in 11 months, incidentally, between here and out of town. And a fellow named Barry Brown came to me and said, you know, I think you got this agent thing going good for you. You need to take a step up. Because Bobby was getting ready to retire. He said, I'm going to give you a guy's number in Florida. Call him. And he gave me the number of a jock named Julio Pazua. So I called Pazua. I says, is this Julio Pazua? He said, yeah. I says, my name is Tony Stabile. I'm an agent in New York. You were the leading rider here in 1988 when the strike broke out, and then you went back to Calder and never came back here. You went to Florida and never came back. Would you come back if I was willing to take your book? He said, who are you? I said, well, let me tell you the truth now. I'm the best agent in New York, and you're the best rider if you were to come to New York. So he said to me, give me your number. I'll call you back in a little bit. So he must have called some people, and they give him the okay. He flew in. I rode one race for Alan Jerkins on a filly named Shopping. She went off the TV screen. It was the first time he run her. He bought her off Scotty Schulhopper. He run her about 10 weeks later. She went off the TV screen. And that showed everybody Pazula was back in town. And he started October 23rd, and we went into the Aqueduct Winter Meet with a full head of steam, and we probably would have beaten Mike Smith for the title if we didn't have so many days. The fact that he got dazed and the fact that Mike Smith picked up about 20 of our winners meant the difference of us winning the title. But I was fortunate with Pazua. I had a great rider named Filiberto Leon, probably the best bug rider I ever saw, including Coffin, including all the bug riders. He could hit a horse left-handed, which Alan Jerkins loves. You know, that was a big thing with him. If a jock could hit a horse left-handed and get him to change leads, you know, that's the guy he wanted. But Filiberto did something that I don't believe any other apprentices have done in the last 30, 40 years. When he had the 5-pound bug, I won 3 grade 1 stakes with him on 3 different horses. That's a little known fact.
Well, that's impressive.
A race in Arlington, the Arlington Oaks for Del Carroll. And he won two grade one Fallon Jerkins in New York, the Cumley, and I believe, and the, not New York, one was in New York, and the other one was the Meadowlands Breeders' Cup. And with Racehack, it was 150,000 grade one with the bug. And I had another great bug rider, Errol Lewis Vaz. I had Travis Dunkelberger, who went on to be like the king of Charlestown. Raul Rojas, Walter Guerra, Kent DeSormo, Paul Sindab. Paul Sindab was a real good bug rider, but he grew out of the saddle. But he was as good as any rider there. And I was fortunate. I was fortunate to have decent riders. And the last rider I had as an agent was a fellow that rides in Presque Isle named Eddie Dominguez. He's as good a rider as there is. Believe me when I tell you, he just doesn't have the exposure. So I was blessed. I did well as an agent. Every jock I had, I made a living with. And I'm not doing it anymore because training's been my first love from the beginning. And clients are hard to come by. Clients are hard to come by. And sometimes when you do come by a decent client, they all of a sudden turn into Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons overnight.
Everybody wants to be a trainer.
Everybody wants. You know, I trained for a fellow named Edgar Bayer. He's the one that brought me back into training in Presque Isle. We ran $7,500 up to $250,000. Our first meet. And we started the meet 5 weeks late. I claimed a filly named Orzo for $7,500. And she just kept winning races, and I kept claiming horses with the money she won. And then I claimed a horse named Black Tie Event. Same thing. I took him for $7,500. We kept winning starter handicaps and allowance races. And that money, we claimed more horses with. And another horse named Symphony 41, I claimed for $12,500. I run him back for $25,000. He won a couple more races with him, and we claimed the rest of the barn. So those three horses bought us $20,000.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And Eddie had other business ventures that were taking up too much of his time. He wound up selling his part of Hill Farm to a business lady from Erie, and I stayed with her until it'll be 3 weeks ago Saturday. You know, she was a nice lady, you know, didn't complain much, put her money up, but evidently she got around some quote-unquote advisors, and it got to the point where she was telling me what strategy to, how to race to us, put them on a lead or take them back. Put blinkers on, take blinkers off. Don't run them in this race. You got to run them in that race. So I finally said, you know what? I've done my bid. I did the best I could. Please take your horses out of my barn. So she took seven horses out of the barn and gave them to the leading trainer at Presque Isle. But I don't mind because I know I did the right thing. I did the best I could. You know, and I know that I have other clients in the wings. So that's the way the game goes. You don't want to burn any bridges either.
No.
That's the other thing. Because you never know when you're going to get back together with somebody.
That's right. That's exactly right.
You know, whatever it is, you let bygones be bygones and business is business. You might change your relationship tactics with them. You might not go out to dinner with them anymore, or you might not be on the phone an hour a day with them anymore. But, you know, business is business. And sometimes trainers do have the whole card to certain horses. So they might want to try and you know, make a deal. You can come back and say, listen, this horse ain't doing no good, but he did good with you. You want to take him. So sometimes you do, sometimes you don't.
Yeah. Well, I read, when I was doing research for this program, I read that you've always been an animal guy, that you like dogs and horses, and you had a way when you were younger with kind of mean type dogs. You used to be able to handle
I'm
them.
Like a, what do they call it? I believe the term is idiot savant.
Uh-huh.
Like the meanest dog won't bite me. I went to a friend's house one day. I had to bring him some specialty stuff from a store in Manhattan. And I went to the house. I rang the bell. His wife let me in, greeted me, let me in. All of a sudden, this giant black chow come running at me. And he come down the steps screaming at his wife, I told you to lock the dog up. The dog started licking me. He was notorious for biting anybody that came near the house. He looked at me, he says, you're a freak. He said, there's something wrong with you because that dog will kill you. And I explained to him, I said, listen, on my block when I was growing up, there was a German shepherd named Shep. He'd go after everybody. As soon as he would see me, when I would get close to him, he'd start wagging his tail and trying to jump up on me. So I've been fortunate in life. And, you know, animals, two things don't lie, animals and kids. And the worst kids, the worst bratty kids, there are no such thing as a bad kid. I mean, just act the way they act sometimes. I love all children, believe me when I tell you that. But the ones that are what we would consider bratty or bad kids or nasty kids, they just seem to I'm like a magnet. They come to me, they don't, and the parents say to me, what do you do? Did you give this kid some kind of tranquilizer or something? you know why? Because they know that I'm sincere. They know that I won't hurt them. And when I speak to them, I don't speak to them on different levels. Like a lot of people who talk to a kid with baby talk and stuff like that. I try and relate to them. I try and lower myself to their age. Yet, let them understand that I'm the older of the two and just try and work a conversation where the kids are comfortable. It's that simple. Same thing with animals. They sense when you're afraid or you're nasty or you're bad. They know you can't fool kids and animals. And I've been blessed in my lifetime to be, good with both.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I think that has a lot to do with, intuition too. When you claim a horse, like you talked about the horses that you claimed for that man and had the fantastic meet with. What's your philosophy when you're looking for horses to claim?
Okay, I have no in between. I have a claim from the best trainer or the worst trainers. I don't go. I don't look to claim off middle of the road guys. If I feel a horse really needs a lot of work nutritionally, medicinally, cosmetically, I'll go after them. If I like a horse from a leading trainer, I'll look back to see who's had the horse before them, if there was anybody, and then I'll go after that horse. I don't go for the middle of the road trainers because I know how they run their operations. See, I'm a student of the game. There's nobody I don't know. I don't have to know them personally to know their MO. And I just wait and wait and wait. And, I've been fortunate. I'm really fortunate. I took one for that lady who I asked to leave the barn. And her partner, about a month and a half ago, I watched this horse run. I said, you know what? I think I can improve this horse. His name was Namarunu. I took him for $62.50. I run him back for $12.5. He went strangled. He went by four lengths strangled. Went easy. I ran him back in allowance race, and that's where my trouble started with my owners. They wanted me to run him in a slaughter handicap. I told them, no, this horse is too good for the slaughter handicap. This horse is going to run an allowance race. Then I'm going to come back on August 19th in a slaughter handicap, but the pot's 34,000. It's part of the distance series at Presque Isle. This horse is begging to run a mile and a half. So we'll go to the allowance race first, a mile and an eighth, then the allowance race to start our allowance on the 19th. Well, the starter handicap went that day also, and it happened to be the race before ours. And some ordinary horse won the race, and then we ran and finished third. But the fact of the matter is there was no pace. They went three-quarters of a mile and 15 and change, going a mile and an eighth. And the horses that ran 1-2, you couldn't buy for $50,000 apiece. If you went to the owners and or trainers of those two horses and said, look, I'll give you $50,000, they'd laugh at you. Now, I had taken my horse for $62.50 two starts back. Run him for the 12-5, he win. Then I ran him in this race and finished third. So economically, first time I run him, I got the owners got $10,200. And then he run third in the allowance race, they got another $3,200. So altogether, they got $13,400. They paid $62.50. So that's like $7,000 profit, and they still own the horse. Yet they still weren't happy because I didn't run them in the slot of handicap. That's the way the game is. That's what we have to deal with. Sometimes it borders on lunacy.
Yeah, sometimes.
But, you know, everybody's an advisor. Everybody's got an opinion. And you know what everybody else has. So, you know, you got to just take it with a grain of salt and move on.
Yeah.
I had a horse in, and again, I'm not mentioning any names or anything. I had a horse in for an owner, and this owner kept telling me, I really want to see this horse in front. I said, listen, we're taking him back. He's run great. Me taking him back, he doesn't want to be on the engine anymore. Right before I walked into Saddle Horse, she comes up to me and says, well, listen, if this horse don't run any good today, the next time you're going to change the equipment and you're going to put... I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You want him on a lead, you got it. Walked in the paddock, I saddled the horse, the jock came out, I said, okay, jock, send him. But I thought we would do... No. She wants him in front, send him. We sent him, he got nothing. I looked at her after the race, I says, and? Now what?
Yeah.
No, what do you want to say now? Well, he wouldn't have won anyway. I said, you're right. You know why? Because you know everything. I know nothing. You know everything. You're in the gate 6 months. I've been out here 47 years. You're a genius. See you tomorrow.
Hold that thought.
I bought a horse out of a field for these people, out of a field in California named Total Distraction. Covered in mud, you couldn't even see him. And he's a gray horse. He looked like a sniper. When I bought him.
Hold that thought, because we got to go to break. We'll be right back after these words.
Nominations are now open to the Fasig Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. The sale annually produces the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world, and in 2018 sold 22 horses for $1 million or higher. Held the Monday after the Breeders' Cup, this one-night sale offers leading racing and broodmare prospects, proven producers, and selected yearlings in the most electric atmosphere you will find at any thoroughbred auction. Nominate your best today, the Fasig Tipton November Sale, where stars shine brightest.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the Phipps in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
Have you tried Daily Racing Form's Saratoga single-day bundles? Get everything you need for the day, including DRF BPs, Clocker Reports, DRF Plus Pro, and Timeform US Betting Strategies. DRF Saratoga single day bundles are available with your choice of Classic Formulator or Timeform US BPs. So now you can maximize your handicapping any day of the meet with DRF Saratoga single day bundles. Visit drf.com/Saratoga to learn more.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Chances galore as they turn for home. Our Dominator comes calling for the lead. Alpha Dar grudgingly gives way. White outside is Best Bud, and here comes Nama Run You rolling down the center of the track. And now on the outside, Nama Run You hits the top. Dreams the Argonne battles along with Fox Strike and Alpha Dar. Nama Run You from last to first. A win over Alpha Dar, Fox Strike, and Dreams D'Argent.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. This is Jude Feld, and I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. Back to our conversation with trainer Tony Stabile. And Tony, before we left for break, you were talking about a horse you picked out of a field full of mud and not really looking like a horse, total distraction.
He looked like a donkey, a sniper donkey. So, but he looked like an athlete, you know. His pedigree was just ordinary. So I got the horse going finally. Then there was some issues with him. I yelled at him. I sent him back to a fellow named Eric Guerin in Erie who's good with bad horses because he was starting to get cuckoo on a racetrack and making pirouettes and lefts and rights. So Eric took him out to his farm, straightened him out, sent him back to me. Well, I took him back out to California, and I got him ready, and I'm telling you, this horse started, he went from a complete juvenile delinquent to a perfect gentleman in one day. I don't know what happened. Light just went on in his head, and he stopped all his antics, and he started training like a bear. I couldn't believe it. Well, I run him first time, I thought I was robbing the racetrack. He was 35-1, and all his works were legitimate. Every work was printed. He gets slowed coming out of the gate. 12 wide around a racetrack, gets beat a length and 3/4. I run him back Easter Sunday. He went wire to wire. 22, 45, 57-1, 104-1. As I'm walking out of the paddock, Jerry Hollendorfer comes over to me. He said, "That's some nice horse you got there." I said, "Thanks, Jerry." He says, "Congratulations, you did a good job." He said, I watched that horse in the morning because he was great. You know, he's a great horse, pretty horse. He said, "I'll give you $100,000 for him." I said, "What?" He says, "Tell your owner, I'll give her $100,000. I want to come over tomorrow morning and look at him. I'll bring my vet." He came the next morning. He examined him in the stall. My man took him out. He jogged him up and down the road. The vet came, looked at him, concreted the offer. My owner turned it down. Yeah. Could have made a tremendous profit. Didn't happen. That's what we got to put up with in this business.
Yeah, that happens. That happens.
P.S. I ran him back 3 weeks later. He chipped his knee. Mm. So, you know what I'm saying? It's things like that that make you want to. You know, when I called and tendered the offer, instead of saying, "Wow, $100,000, how much do you get out of that?" That was my response. You know, what can I do? What can I say? I said, I get 5% on a sale. I get 10% of what he earns, but 5% if you sell him. Well, you know what? Tell him we want 120. He was given top dollar as it was at 100. You know, I knew he wouldn't give 120. I told him anyway. He said, nah, forget it. No, but it's things like that. Again, people need to be educated. If you don't mind, Jude, I'd like to expound on two things that are really important to me.
Go ahead.
As far as maybe this will help some trainers too. People don't realize, trainers in particular, don't realize how important it is for you to be racing and have a working relationship with the people that run that track. And again, I got no allegiances to anybody. I'm an independent. I do my thing. I go coast to coast. I can go anywhere I want. The people in the Shawnock group at Golden Gate, Dave Duggan, Patrick Mackey, Steve Martinelli, Carrie Fawcett, all the girls in the office there. I'll tell you what. They make it so easy for a trainer to do business. They'll remind you about races. Of course, they're going to try and hustle you, especially in this day and age with the shortage of horses. But if they do hustle you and you need a race somewhere down the line, you're going to get your race. They work with you. They're not looking for me. They look to help you. If you need to expand, they do everything they can to give you extra stalls. The facility, a guy named William Rizzuto came in to the facility. He started whipping the facility into shape, again, at the behest of Duggan and Patrick Mackey. So that place, as far as catering to trainers, a place would have to really, 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 really work very hard to match them. It makes it so easy for me to go in there and coordinate my barn and get everything ready. And they come to the barn and help you. Like when I shipped in the first time, Patrick Mackey came to the barn with my PPs. He said, here's your PPs on your horses. Here's the new book. You know, I knew what all my horses were eligible for. Now he gives me a printout of the new book. Now I know where I can go. You don't get that kind of courtesy. Another place, Presque Isle, Alan Plever. I think Alan Plever, Pat Mackey, and Mike Lake are the three greatest racing secretaries I ever raced with because they care for the horsemen. It's a very, very, very important thing that you have harmony with the horsemen. Maybe their higher-ups don't have the relationship that they should, which is most of the time a lot of places. As far as Golden Gate and Presque Isle, you got to be stupid not to race there if you have the opportunity at both places. Presque Isle, Matt Ennis, the president, Kevin O'Sullivan, and like I said, Alan Plever, the greatest. The marketing lady there, Jennifer C., the greatest. You need something, need a reservation, you need passes, you need this, you need, no problem. Same thing Golden Gate. Never a problem. They cater to us. That's what we need. There's one other thing that's really, really, really gnawing at me. I've been watching everything with the Shawnock group, with Hollendorfer, Del Mar, stuff in Louisiana. I'm going to tell you what our game needs. Like baseball, hockey, football, basketball, they have a commissioner. We need a commissioner. You know, I've spoke to a lot of people in the past couple of weeks. They can't even tell me who the three people who head the TRA are. For whatever reason, they're not out there. They don't put themselves out there. And that's supposed to be our representative body. We have one problem is our main problem. There is no uniformity of the medication rules. None. Zero. It's not in Major League Baseball. I mean, professional baseball. The major leagues and minor leagues are blanketed. Uniform rules. A guy gets suspended for drugs, for this drug or whatever drug. It's the same suspension in double-A ball as it is in major league. But when it comes to horse racing, if the leading trainer in whatever state and a guy in Okefenokee Downs, all up, a lower caliber racing place like Will Rogers Downs, let's say, and a trainer in California get the same drug positive, especially if that trainer in California is one of the leading trainers, you can bet me he's going to get less days than the guy in Will Rogers Downs. I see it time and time and again. That's the norm. That shouldn't be. We need somebody who's going to come in, coordinate our business. The other thing is the thing with the licensing. I mean, you know, it's like being shook down. Like, certain states are like a mob. They just shake you down for every quarter they could get out of you. You need to pay this for authorized agent. You need to pay this for stable name. You need to pay this to register your colors. No good. One price. North America. You're licensed in New York. You're licensed in California, Chicago. One license, one time. Nobody's coordinating this. There's no commissioner to oversee everything. There's no board to rule on things. The way the world is today, the world can't even get themselves straightened out. You see what goes on in Congress and with the these gangs. You see the way our president is treated. They'd have treated the president like this 30 years ago, 40 years ago. They'd all been in jail for saying what they say and doing what they do. So it's that bad in the country. You think anybody cares about horse racing? But we have to do it ourselves. We need to police it. We need to get a commissioner. We need to vote on a board. We need uniformity. Rules, regulations, licensing. I'm going to tell you something too, and believe me, I know the guy like this for 40 years. We've never went to dinner together, never ever socialized. I'm going to tell you who would be a good guy for that. A fellow named Gary Contessa. He's well-liked. He's well-versed. He's wrote a manifest. It was published in the Pollock Report. I've watched his videos. We need to get a guy like that. If he would give up training, I don't know if he would even do that. But that's the person we need, or a person like him. You know, he cares. That's another thing. He cares. He's very helpful. The backstretch people love him. The owners love him. Management loves him. You got to get Gary Contessa or somebody like him. And he's probably going to kill me for me saying this because he does not know I was going to do this to him. That's what we need. Even maybe Jude Fell, too.
Yeah. Well, I always thought a good commissioner. I always thought I would be good at it. But, you know, the thing is, you're 100% correct. The hurdle we face, of course, is every state is different. I mean, I learned that the hard way, or the easy way, maybe. In California, right. Trainer's license, $300, right? So I ran in Arkansas one day, and I went to Arkansas and get my trainer's license, and they said that'll be $10.
Right. Well, Delaware is $5.
What? $10?
Delaware is $5.
Yeah.
I've never seen you in person. You're a pretty big guy, right? Like
yeah. Me. Yeah, definitely.
Do you know we could go to Delaware for $5 and get a jockey license? Yes, that's no lie.
That's fine.
$5, you get a jockey's license. Now, even though I was an agent, I wouldn't even entertain taking your book.
Yeah, no, no.
No hard feelings.
I'd be good at Bombay Dance.
You know, that's what it is. Sure, you want a license? $5, just give us the money.
Yeah.
I mean, even though it's $5, you know it's never going to happen. But they'll still sell it to you.
Yeah.
You know, and another thing. And, you know, I'm from Missouri. You got to show me. And I have to admit something. I've been very ignorant as far as adhering to some of this stuff. But a dear friend of mine for 40 years named Bob Fox has been after me for the past 4 or 5 years to start using natural oils and essential oils and salves and herbs on horses. I'm going to tell you something. Now, Bob's not a vendor. I'm not a vendor, so you'd have to go out on your own and get it. But it works. I couldn't believe how good the natural oils and herbs work on horses. It's just like, I have neuropathy, bad neuropathy. He gave me a mixture to use, geranium, frankincense, lavender, and hemp oil. Since I started using it, it's not gone. It's never going to go. But my life has been so much better. I could never sleep through at night. Using these essential oils, I can sleep through. Now think about how that works with the horses. I had one horse there. I'm not going to mention his name. When I got the oils for myself, I started using them on him. I only incorporated another salve into another natural salve. I never put a bandage on him again. And he had knees and ankles. I just would put the oils in my hand. I'd take a little scoop of the salve, rather, drop the oils on it, and rub it into his knees and ankles. No bandages, no sweat, no nothing. It works. So these are things that a lot of trainers don't know about, and they don't, you know, maybe entertain or experiment with that can help the horses. It really, really helps them. And the last thing I want to see is a sore horse. You know, I mean, you've been through it, Jude. I don't have to tell you. You've been through the wars. The worst thing happened to me this year, I had a filly break her knee inside the 16th pole here. She never took a bad step in her life. It happens. You don't know. Things happen. With all of this PETA and all these other organizations, no. It's not abuse. If these horses weren't taken care of by us, they'd be running around being chased by wolves and bears. They don't understand that, people. We give the best care to these horses. We give all our time to them, our blood, our sweat, our tears. It took me 2 weeks to get over that filly. People don't understand. They're not just our horses. They're our children. They're like blood to us, those horses. So I just hope the public could, you know, get behind racing again like it was in the 50s and 40s. Come out. Ask questions. I wish the racetracks would educate them. Have the breakfast mornings on the weekends.
Oh, those things are invaluable, like breakfast at Belmont that Anthony does. Oh. And great program at Santa Anita, taking the fans back on trams through the barn area and showing them what goes on back there. I believe in that stuff 100%. And there's so many opportunities for fans to learn. And the racetracks just have to provide, the vehicle for them to learn it. I mean, it's there, and people want to come out. They want to see the horses. They want to be able to touch them and be close to them. And, I think they should do more of that. Keeneland does a great job with that on Saturday mornings. You see so many families coming out, and the pony riders are great to the kids, and there's programs for them.
And you know what else people should do, whether they can afford it or not? They should go and go to the sales just so they could witness the magic at these sales. Forget about just looking at the horse and look at the expression on people's faces that when they're bidding and stuff like that, they're hoping that probably the first week of May, what they're buying in that ring is going to be standing in the winner's circle there. You know, this business, our business, is built on two things. A very, very wise man told me this once. One of the greatest selectors of horses I've ever seen in my life. He was the greatest. He told me, don't ever forget this. This game is built on two things, hype and opinion. And if you really think about it, he's 100% right. 100% right. Now, it just takes us to coordinate ourselves together again, get the game back where it should be, and hopefully everybody will be fine. The animals come first. We understand that. That's our main job, is to keep the animals safe. Between the safety rails, the whip rules, medication rules, that's the way it's going to be.
If you just joined us, this is Jude Feld, and I'm visiting with trainer Tony Stabile on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Yeah, that would be just wonderful if we could get back to the good old days where the trainers were all helping one another and
exactly, it was camaraderie.
Right.
See what people don't understand? It used to be one guy owned 40 horses. Now 40 guys own one horse.
Right.
And that's fine. Yeah. That's great that everybody gets a chance to live the dream. But you know what? It's got to be constant. We need a fan base. We need people coming out. We need people showing their kids that it's not bad to be at a racetrack. You know, everyone hears, oh, well, there's gambling there. Well, there's gambling everywhere. You know what I'm saying? If you go to a bazaar or a feast, you're betting on numbers and stuff. It's gambling. I mean, people have to keep trying different forms of visiting the track. They want to watch on TV, that's fine. Like the old adage goes, there's nothing like hitting a superfecta in your pajamas. That's the greatest feeling. It's happened to me many times. There's no greater feeling hitting a pick four or a superfecta in your pajamas. Knowing that you go to that account the next morning, it's laying right there for you.
Yeah, that's something else.
Then right to Aqueduct for a fresh nine.
Well, it's a great game, and a lot of people appreciate it. I think it's a great entertainment for family. You know, I learned so much when I was a kid going to the racetrack. As a matter of fact, first book report I ever did was on a book called Making Money on the Races that belonged to my dad, and the nun was not happy with that, and she called my mother and said, you know. But then when fractions came, third grade fractions, I drew a racetrack on the board and on the chalkboard and put in the poles, and I said, well, this is a quarter mile from the finish and this is a half, and she was kind of impressed then.
and the other thing, like I said, with the kids, get to bring the kids out. You know, every track has a park area, game room. You know, if I may, I'll tell you one more quick story about Anthony. I'm an agent at the time, and I wasn't trying to make Anthony a juvenile delinquent or anything, but if he liked the horse, I would bet it for him. I mean, he wasn't stealing, taking his allowance money or his save money and going to a window at 8 years old, 9 years old. I'd ask him who he liked, because he could read the form from when he was about 5 years old. And one day I had a live horse that I was riding in the last race, and he came up to me, he said, Dad, can I bet a double? And can I bet some triples? I said, sure. We had won some races earlier, so I had money aside for him. I said, just tell me what you want. So he gave me his numbers. I wrote them down. I went to the window. I bet it. I handed him the tickets. Oh, P.S., the race is over. The horse wins. And it was me, my ex-wife, my daughter, and a dear friend of mine that passed away a couple of years ago, Richie Frankel, and his wife and daughter. And Anthony comes flying in from outside. He comes running up to us. We're standing under the tote board at Aqueduct. He said, "Folks, Chinese on me tonight."
That's great.
"I got this. I got everything," he says. He's 8 years, 8, 9 years old. "I got everything. Chinese on me." He won about, I think it was $350 or $370.
That's great.
But, you know, he became, by winning a bet like that, he became one of the a racetrack wag.
Right.
You know, he got the thrill of winning. You know, he's seen his father's jockeys winning races. You know, he was involved.
Yeah, it's the only sporting event you can go to and you can get involved for, well, what used to be $2. Now you can get involved for a dime.
Honestly, and again, I'm not, you know, I'm trying not to go overboard here, Jude. Where can you go and bet a buck on a triple or superfecta, pick four, pick five, pick three, pick six, pick your nose, pick anything, and get some of the rewards that they pay?
Yeah, no. No, I know.
You can't
bet a buck and win a grand almost every day of the week.
We're getting for the buck than going to the racetrack.
That's right.
Or the dime.
That's right.
Well, I know guys, they bang out, they kill 40 trees a day with the amount of tickets they bet.
Yeah.
I mean, they got stacks and stacks of 10-cent supers. You know what? They're content. They're only getting a tenth of the payout or a 20th of the payout if it's a $2 bet, but they're happy. And sometimes they catch a $6,000 one. When they use bombs and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it's about.
That's right. Well, believe it or not,
Winston Churchill said, "Nothing better for the inside of a man than the outside of a horse."
That's right.
True words were never spoken.
Yep. Believe it or not, we've come to the end of the hour, and I can't believe it went that fast. I could talk to you for another hour.
I really enjoyed it. I appreciate it. And I hope the people get a better understanding of the game. And I thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. We really appreciate it. Thanks to Lee Della Pina, our producer, for keeping us in line. And remind everybody to listen to the show that launched the network, the Equine Forum, 8 o'clock every Saturday morning. Check the website, horseracingradio.net, for affiliates. SiriusXM information, and we'll talk to you again soon. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.